All right, let's take our Bibles and let's turn to Genesis chapter 9. Our passage this evening will be in Genesis chapter 9, and we'll be looking at verses 1 through 7. And you can also get your handout out, and I will be referring to that at various times in our study tonight. So Genesis chapter 9. Now tonight we're going to be in part 2 of our study of the Noahic Covenant. And what we'll look at tonight is I'm going to review the handout somewhat briefly as opposed to last time. And then we'll look at Roman numeral 1 on the handout, which is I will review the introduction. So just to get our bearings on the context and when this covenant was given to Noah. And then if you see on the handout Roman numeral 2, we'll look at just reviewing those items. But in terms of tonight, mostly what we'll do is we'll review the handout just briefly. I'll review what we looked at last time, the introduction, and some introductory items related to the covenant given to Noah. And then we'll begin looking at Roman numeral 3, which is the contents of the covenant. And so if you have the handout or not, what we'll look at is the items listed under A through D. So we'll look at filling the earth, ruling over the animal realm, a change in food, and then what we would call today capital punishment. Obviously, we'll speak more on that later. That's not the phrase given in the scripture, but that would be more or less what we refer to it as. But before we get into our portion of scripture tonight, which will be Genesis 9, 1 through 7, let me just do a brief review of the handout. So on the handout itself, of course, I start with Genesis 6:18. I have the verse there. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Of course, that is given before, actually, the flood, as we saw that last week. So it makes for a good verse sort of as a header on the outline of the handout. But if you look at the handout, what we have is an introduction, which kind of gives a summary of Genesis 1 through 8. It gives the setting, in other words, of when it happens. And then also under the introduction, I call it starting over after the flood as sort of a reboot. We'll look more at that tonight as well, because after the flood, God will restart and resume what he began prior to the flood. And then under the second Roman numeral there, you see the Noahic covenant, the contents, and the sign of the covenant. And then we have a few quotes there. But what we looked at last time was the introduction and then the items related to the Noahic covenant. So if you recall the setting, and essentially what we have is Genesis chapter 1 through 8 is the background to the covenant giving in Genesis 9. But in chapters 1 through 8, if I were going to summarize it, what I would say is the first three chapters describe the week of creation. So Genesis 1 through 3, the week of creation. Chapter 2 describes the specific details of the sixth day of creation. And of course, we have the fall. I like to call it the fall, not simply of man, which obviously is the case, but also of creation itself and all that is entailed in that. So that would be somewhat of a synopsis of the first three chapters. And then from chapters 4 really through 6 or thereabouts is what you find as the deterioration we looked at society. So Adam and Eve are cast out of Eden. They start to be fruitful and multiply. Murder occurs very quickly. And then you just have this ongoing deterioration of society. And eventually God brings a flood, just as we talked about last week. But prior to the actual event of the flood, as I mentioned already, Genesis 6:18, God promises a covenant with Noah post-flood, or we'd say it would be inferred there or implied that God is going to give this after the flood. And another way you could even think of it is God is promising to deliver Noah and his family through the flood, and we'll start over again with Noah and his family. Now, we also looked at, and if you have your handout, you see Roman numeral 2, item B. What is a covenant? Essentially, it's an agreement, we call it, between two parties. I read a few definitions, but you also could think of it as a promise. There are some downsides to using that phrase, but it is helpful because you could say, for example, I promise to do this if you do this. Now, that would be more of a conditional covenant, but that's the idea there of a covenant. It's a promise made by one party to another, or you could say a promise made between two parties, which gets us to the next point on Roman numeral 2 from last time, which is conditional versus unconditional. The Noahic covenant is unconditional versus some other covenants in the Bible are conditional, and those are just that. God attaches, I don't like to use the term strings, but with a conditional covenant, there are certain conditions, just the word itself. In order for God to fulfill his promise, certain conditions must be met. Whereas on the other hand, if it's unconditional, God is promising to do something regardless. It's just simply, I promise to do this. So an easy way to think of it is, if it's unconditional, which is what the Noahic covenant is, God is essentially saying, I promise to do this, period. If it was conditional, God would say, I promise to do this if you fulfill XYZ, and that would be a conditional covenant. And then lastly, before we look at our text tonight, universal, if you remember, the covenant with Noah is a universal covenant, whereas we might have, for instance, the Davidic covenant, later given in 2 Samuel, for instance, chapter 7, that one given with the house of David. So that one's very specific, whereas this one is universal. And I think that will help as we look at some of these contents as well, that God is making these promises in particular not to flood the earth again globally, and there's no condition attached to it for man to fulfill. So we can be thankful that that won't happen again in a global sense, but we also see where it's universal, this promise, so it's not focused on just the Israelites as we may think of with some other covenants. So now, having said all of that, let's read Genesis, and I'll do this, Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 through 7, and we'll review the contents now of that covenant. So as we read this, the flood has subsided, and the first thing Noah does at the end of chapter 8 is worship God, give a sacrifice, and they begin to go about starting over again. So let's read Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 through 7, and then we'll look at these contents of the covenant. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. Only you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. As for you, be fruitful and multiply and populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it." So now as we go forward here, looking at the contents of the covenant, again, Noah and his family, they exit the ark after the flood has subsided and that period of time has elapsed. They offer a sacrifice, they worship the Lord, and God is pleased with them. And as I began reading it, you'll notice that God blessed Noah and his sons. And then the first of the, and we're looking at here, if you have your handout, not necessary, but if you want to refer to it, Roman numeral 3, we're going to go through items A through D. And this one is the first one, which is to fill the earth. So this would be a similar command, if you recognize there is a bit of familiarity here with what was given to Adam. And it's again reiterated or repeated in verse 7. But the first thing is that they need to repopulate the earth. So God's desire is to repopulate the earth because, of course, obviously everything has been destroyed, barring what was on the ark. And so God is going to start over again, and you could think of it as to reboot. I'm sure we all have had a computer or a phone that gets stuck and you shut it down and you reboot it. Well, in effect, God is doing that with his creation. There is sin and judgment that came upon the earth, but yet God's promises were sure and certain. He would redeem, bring a Messiah, all of those aspects, but in order to get back to what God's purposes were for creation, they have to go back and repopulate. And you could see a similar command was given to Adam in Genesis 1:28, and it says, God blessed them and said to them, that's Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. So very similar there, and nothing particularly unique here other than God's desire to repopulate the earth, to reboot his creation and start over again. So as we move on then to the next item that relates to this contents of the covenant section, is that they're called, humans are, mankind, to rule over the animal realm. Again, this first part of this isn't necessarily unique, but it is a little bit varied here with the earlier account in Genesis, the week of creation. Notice how it's different in Genesis 9:2. It says, the fear of you and the terror of you will be upon every creature, every beast of the earth, every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground. I like to jokingly think of that as, you know, that's why when you encounter a cockroach, they flee. They're on the ground and they creep on the ground and they flee. Fish. But all of that, in all seriousness, is the idea of the end of verse 2. It's given into their hand. This is the idea of dominion, that God has given humans the authority to exercise rulership over creation. And so we see this here, the rule over the animals, and it would be different. There are some who see this as a change in the way animal behavior was pre-flood. And essentially what that would be is the idea, if you've ever seen or heard that or read about that, is that perhaps animals prior to the flood were similar in their characteristics as other humans were. If you remember, the whole earth was filled with violence and so forth, that perhaps animals had become wild and uncontrollable. Of course, we don't know that, but if you do encounter that, that would be the general idea. But nevertheless, this idea of man ruling over the animals would be different. There is fear and terror would now characterize the relationship between animals and humans. And we can see that today. And again, it's not in the sense of perfection. We do have some, if we would say, anomaly situations. But by and large, that is the case we see. But one of the things I think is worth pointing out here, so that we don't go to an extreme here, would be that man was to be a good steward of what God had entrusted in him. In this case, it would be, of course, the animal realm. And when you think of stewardship, and I know the typical tendency, and I understand why, which is to think of the monetary or something akin to that. But when we think of stewardship, we also need to make sure that we remember that all the things that we have that God has given to us, he expects us to handle it and use it and appropriate it in a responsible way. And so in terms of this animal situation here, the idea of being a good steward over the creation in terms of animals is we wouldn't be cruel to them. So we do have authority, we do have a responsibility to exercise authority over animals, yet at the same time, we don't want to be cruel to animals. Let me read you this from Ken Fleming's commentary and of Genesis. Really good commentary, but also a good quote. Fleming writes, "People were free to handle them, that is animals, as they pleased, but always as responsible stewards of God's creation. There is no license given here to abuse animals," end quote. So now, having looked at the command to fill the earth, to rule over the animal realm, the next thing you'll see there, and it's item C, which is to change, there is a change in food. Sometimes it's called a change in diet. I suppose you could call it that as well. And so the idea of that would be that the diet or restrictions have changed. And before, it would seem as though that humans would have been vegetarian, we would think of today, in terms of their diet. In other words, they weren't meat eaters. And let's look at Genesis 1:29 so we can see that, where that comes from. And again, this command, very similar, Adam and Eve, but of course, the one with Noah has the variant to it. But look at Genesis 1:29. "Then God said, Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed." But notice the end, "it shall be food for you." And so the idea there is that, and you can see the rest in verse 30, it's similar as well, the idea of plants being food for Adam and Eve and the early inhabitants of the earth. And so there was previously a diet there where you think of vegetarian, but now there is the permission of God to be able to eat food. Notice verse 3, so this is Genesis 9:3. So again, Genesis 9:3, "Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you," just as he's referring there to the green plant, which is back in Genesis. But something's different with this change in food, or this change in diet, we might think of in our vernacular today. Notice the one prohibition to the meat eating, and it's in verse 4. "Only you shall not eat flesh with its life," that is, its blood. So there is the prohibition there, that while you could eat meat, you couldn't have the blood there, and the idea is that blood represents life. Let me give you two cross references here, and you can, just to get this idea, which of course does evolve over time in creation, in the revelation of God in the scriptures there, but in Leviticus chapter 17 in verse 11, this is relating to the Lord speaking to Moses about the blood that is needed for atonement. But in Leviticus 17:11, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you on the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is in the blood by reason of the life that makes atonement." We also have another reference in Deuteronomy chapter 12. So that's Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 23. And I just want you to see these, that the idea, and of course it increases and there's more detail, and then we have the sacrificial system that comes under the time in which the Israelites are under the Mosaic covenant. But in Deuteronomy 12:23, this here says, "Only be sure not to eat the blood, for the blood is the life, and you shall not eat the life with the flesh." So that's an interesting two verses that we looked at, Leviticus and Deuteronomy, that speak of the idea there of that the life is being representative as blood. Now you might be thinking, okay, well, back in Genesis, what's the point? Where are we going with this? Well, I want you to consider something here, is that the focus now that God is doing and shifting to is a shift of focus on the value and sanctity of all life. Let me mention that again. This is sort of the beginning to where God, especially in the Noahic covenant, shifts his focus on the value, or to the value and sanctity of all life, both animal and human, because we're going to get to the human one in just a few moments. And so we see the contents being to fill the earth and to rule over the animal realm. But then you have the tweak we might think of, or the idea where man needs to treat animals in a certain way, and then his diet changes where he can have meat and he can eat meat, but he has the prohibition there of blood because of the life being in the blood being representative there of life. Now, just sort of as an aside, I'm not a doctor and don't have any way to really explain the nutrition of this, but some suggest, and I'm mostly just mentioning this in case you run across it, but some suggest that prior to the flood, man's diet, of course, was the way that we described it, vegetarian, but that because of the flood, man needed nutritionally to be able to intake meat into their diet. Now, I don't know how all that works, but that you will see some commentaries and some study Bibles that speak of that man's body and the need for nutrition changed, and so thus there was a need for meat. I don't really have an opinion on that. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I just mention it in case you run across something. That's sort of the idea of where that comes from. But more importantly, the shift of focus here is on the value and sanctity of human life. And I think that with the Noahic covenant, that might be one thing that sometimes gets missed, because as we see in the final part three next time, we tend to think of it with the sign of the covenant being the rainbow. But I think that the idea of God's view of human life and animal life as well, but all life being valuable. And I think in our culture today, this is a good reminder, because in our culture today, at least in the United States, the value of human life is just almost non-existent. Human life from the conception in the womb all the way to its last breath, all of it is valuable. All people have value. They are marred by the fall, but they can be redeemed. So the image of God is there. But I want you to begin to see that, because that will move us into our final piece here, which is D on the handout, which is what we call capital punishment. Notice verse 6, which is what we'll focus on to get this. It says, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man." So what we see here is that life is so important, to shed it wrongfully will bring and should bring grave consequences. The idea there is to deter evil, to deter murder. Now, if you think about Genesis 4, it didn't take long and murder occurred. But human life is more and very important, in particular with related to animals, because of one reason. Notice in verse 6, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for," or because, "man was made in God's image," the Imago Dei. No matter who the person is, they have value in the Lord's eyes because they are made after his own image. They are image bearers, and they have certain traits and uniquenesses that we don't find in the animal realm. We don't even find in the angelic realm is either. I would caution you all as well, that we think about, we need to do the same. We need to see all people as in the image of God. They're all valuable. We may not agree with them. We may not like a particular person, or maybe we don't get along with them. But the bottom line is that they still have value in God's eyes. We aren't more valuable. We're all equally valuable. But of course, that doesn't mean that a person isn't sinful, doesn't need the gospel. It isn't marred by the fall. All life is marred by the fall and needs to be redeemed through Christ. But that's secondary, or a second item, I should say, to the fact that you and I need to value people and see them, even those that we don't like, we need to see them that way. And I think it would cut down on so much hostility. But again, let me just be clear. We need to value human life, all of it, all humans. We also need to understand that just like us, we need to be redeemed by Christ, because that's ultimately what changes people. But let's look at a few things too to consider with this idea of capital punishment. And I'll give you a resource as well. In the Old Testament, there's a difference between killing and murder. I think a killing would be self-defense, for example, whereas what the Bible's speaking of here is murder. So this is the idea of homicide or something premeditated. I think of the story of Cain and Abel, which is in Genesis 4. But you'll see there that man needs to execute judgment and this punishment in certain situations. And this is where the role of civil or human government comes into play. I do believe, and I'm one who believes, that although there may be some loose formations prior to the flood, that here is where we have the beginning of civil or human government. So this is the establishment of a formal governmental system that would execute this type of judgment. We would think of it as civil or just government in general today. Let's look at two passages real quick. Romans chapter 12, or excuse me, Romans chapter 13 again, rather. Romans chapter 13. And there Paul gives instructions to Christians on the need to be subject to every human authority, those governing authorities. This is Romans 13. It says that they were established, Romans 13, 1, by God. Human government was established in this formal sense by God and is held accountable to God. But this is somewhat a story for another day, you might say. But notice verse 4, Paul says, "For it, human government, is a minister of God for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing." This sword, the idea of judgment, or the idea of executing, for instance, in this case, capital punishment, is given to the governmental authorities, not to individuals. So I think that that's a little bit needing clarification. So this is something so that we don't have people running around killing one another. This would be done in certain situations by the government, the civil human authority here. And then you also have a passage in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13. Beginning in verse 13, it says, "To submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as one in authority, or to governors as sent by him," the him there would be God, "for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right." So again, the idea is still the same. The main point, Romans 13, 1 Peter, as well as back in Genesis, is that human government was established as a deterrent. Now, again, it's not a permanent solution. The permanent solution is the gospel of Jesus Christ. It is a heart that is changed. But government is meant to restrain evil. And it would be needed if you think of what has just happened in Genesis 9. Well, the flood has just happened. Judgment upon the earth has happened because man, if there was nothing in terms of some sort of formal governmental system, I mean, man would just run loose as was in the days of Noah. I'm going to read you something. This comes from Henry Morris's commentary in Genesis, and I think it's helpful here. "There was no formal mechanism for the punishment of a crime or of crime prevention, as is evident in the histories of Cain and Lamech," see Genesis 4. "Evidently, each person was able to act quite independently of all restraints, for this eventually led to a universal state of violence and anarchy. To prevent the development of similar conditions after the flood, God established the institution of human government, including especially the authority for capital punishment," Henry Morris, end quote. Now, if you're interested in this subject, because I know it is a bit complex and involved, and time has changed. I mean, we've got quite some period of time since the Noahic Covenant. There's a particular article by Charles Ryrie called The Doctrine of Capital Punishment. The article is freely published online. If you'd like a copy of it, you can either email me or I can give you a copy. It comes from a book that he wrote in the late 70s called You Mean the Bible Teaches That? And this is one of those issues that he covers. And it's fairly succinct, but he does a good job of describing biblically why this was given and answers some, I think, helpful questions as to when and how this would be used and those sorts of things. But before I look at taking questions, I want you to consider, though, one of the main key points with this Noahic covenant, as we've covered so far, which is that God values human life, and we should too. We should see others as having value because they're made in the image of God, whether we care for them or agree with them or not. And we know that God values human life so much because, quite honestly, he loved it so much that he sent his own son one day. His own son died on the cross, was buried, he rose again on the third day, and when we trust, we believe in him, we have eternal life. And it makes me think of, and I have thought of this hymn so often with this, how deep the Father's love for us, how vast beyond all measure, that he should give his only son to make a wretch his treasure. We'll pick up next time and conclude with the flood-related items and the sign of the covenant. But I'll take questions now if you have any.